Hey everyone, welcome back to the Waxcast episode 31. I'm your host, Gavin Wax, and today I'm joined by a good friend of mine, someone who I butt heads with a decent amount of times on various issues, but mostly the environment, environmentalism, and the role of government in protecting trees, plants, and you know all that crap. But I wanted to bring on my good friend, John Harding Sweeney, who is also the national spokesman for Republic N. That's Republic with E-N at the end, and he'll have to explain the branding and how that makes sense. But John, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Glad to be on the Waxcast for the first time.
Yes. Well, we had a bit of an issue earlier with our live stream. So now we're back in action and everything seems good so far. But I wanted to bring you on because I'm familiar with your articles, your work, since we are friends and we have talked a bit about, you know, environmentalism and its role within the conservative movement, within the Republican movement. I do think there is some changes going on right now. I do think that the emergent populist right within the Republican Party would be more hospitable for forms of environmentalism along the lines of, say, what Teddy Roosevelt may have done with, you know, the national parks and a whole slew of other things. And I do think there is a cultural component that many people who do ascribe to, you know, conservative ideology or Republican politics, you know, they do like the outdoors. These are people that live in rural areas and they are actually in nature, you know, compared to maybe some of their cosmopolitan liberal cousins in this country. So I do think it's always been an interesting dynamic culturally, but do you see the same shift I'm seeing in the Republican Party, in the conservative movement, towards being more hospitable to environmentalist type of views?
Yeah, I definitely see a shift happening, and it's a shift that we obviously welcome on what we call the eco-right. It's an issue, climate change and global warming is an issue that we've been talking about for several years now, and it's been mostly associated with the left and Democrats, and traditionally not a Republican issue. But I think as more people start to see the effects of climate change and extreme weather events actually coming to their backyards, you see more Republican voters starting to wake up to the issue and think that it's worthy of addressing at the federal level. The questions are what solutions are appropriate and the best ones to tackle this problem. And that's where you get these differences between the eco-right and call it the eco-left.
Yeah, well, the eco-left is definitely not my cup of tea, mostly because what you describe, you know, their policy prescriptions for handling environmental issues generally seem to be just excuses to pave the way towards some form of Marxism or expansion of the state and further control over our lives, our businesses, our industries, et cetera, et cetera. It also seems to tend to be kind of the politics of, I don't even know how to describe it, the upper middle class, the elites, a type of policy issue that comes in handy for many people who are sort of, you know, well off economically, but it's not really an issue that comes to mind for, you know, working class people, most middle class people who are mostly thinking in terms of, you know, economics and maybe even cultural. Environmentalism always seems to be relegated to those who, I don't know, basically the Davos crowd, the John Kerry's of the world, the people that do fly private jets and tend to not adhere to any of the virtues they preach. I mean, is that a wrong assessment? Is that, you know, am I biased in saying that?
No, I think what you're saying is what a lot of people see, which is there's some hypocrisy. And then there's also, I think there's a lot of disingenuity on the left when it comes to the environment sometimes. Like there's several disingenuous elements that are embedded within that environmental left movement that I think turns a lot of Republicans off. And it's a well-known phenomenon in capitalism and markets that when you have a monopoly, consumer choices and just overall quality deteriorates. And we've witnessed that firsthand with the fact that Democrats have had a monopoly on this whole climate argument for so long. And I think the theme of capitalism and markets and the power of markets and competition is something that the right and Republicans can bring into the conversation. And that's going to be a recurring theme that we talk about today here on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've always, you know, I always remember hearing about, you know, the Milton Friedman view of things where, you know, the environment is always taken care of in places where it had strong property, private property rights, because if it's your own property, or you have an incentive to take care of it. And generally speaking, I was always supportive of ideas that expanded private property rights to the air or to the water or things like that. So there is some sort of way to measure. There is some sort of way to create liability for pollution and things like that. I always found that those were interesting solutions that worked within existing legal frameworks, existing property structures that could simply be improved upon rather than creating, you know, whole new regulatory bodies and tons of new legislation that was mostly designed pretty much to cripple industry and business. But one interesting...
By the way, also a very good argument against socialism. Like if you look back at some of the most socialist regimes like Soviet Russia... Terrible environmental record because they didn't have these private property rights. And it's so ironic that you have so many socialist elements in the environmental left today that are saying that socialism is somehow a solution to climate change. And that it couldn't be further from the truth. Like that socialism has a terrible track record when it comes to the environment.
Yeah, even today, even in corporatist China or quasi-communist, quasi-corporatist China, I mean, some of the worst, you know, quantitative metrics for pollution, for the environment, for their damage to the ecosystem. And I mean, and that's because they have very little regard for private property.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one other interesting issue that, you know, not issue, but policy proposal that I've seen you bring up and others bring up, particularly among this this new eco-right, as you called it, is the idea of carbon tariffs. Now, I'm kind of a protectionist myself. I've been, you know, open to tariffs as a way to shift away revenue from domestic taxation. You know, I'm all for lowering domestic taxes on individuals and businesses and shifting it to tariffs in order to protect, you know, domestic industry, in order to fight off this gross trade imbalance that we have going on, where we're not producing any of our own goods. I mean, that's a whole other discussion that could be delved into in terms of trade and protectionism. But the idea, the name, the concept, when it's brought up, of carbon tariffs is a little interesting to me, someone who is a protectionist, who is more on the populist right. So I'm interested in hearing if you could explain it, I guess, in layman's terms or not layman's terms, whatever way you want to do it. But what are carbon tariffs? How does this thing work?
So carbon tariffs is a term. I don't know if I was the first one to come up with it. Probably not. But it's, you know, in politics, I think that terminology is very important for communication and whenever you're talking to certain audiences. And one of the things that we get tripped up on a lot in the environmental movement just broadly is the lexicon and using wonky policy terms that don't connect with average, you know, everyday people. I think there's a big disconnect with the environmental movement in terms of like, how does this relate to my personal life? How can this make my life better if we do these measures to combat climate change? And like, is it going to take away more than it gives back? So there's a lot of, I think there are a lot of communication disconnects that that we need to bridge. But one of the disconnects that I was trying to bridge here with the idea of carbon tariffs is one of the primary solutions that Republican and many other eco-right organizations advocate to combat climate change is a carbon tax, so, or carbon pricing, whatever you want to call it. The way it would work is you would basically put a flat tax of some sort on, like $40 per ton is one of the measures that is often cited by economists as a starting point for carbon emissions, and you would implement that domestically, and then it would have what we call a border adjustable component. So in policy wonk terms, it's a carbon tax that is revenue neutral and border adjustable. And when you say those words, most people just hear the word tax and they go, "Egh," especially conservatives, like, no, I just heard tax and I don't know what any of those other words necessarily mean. The border adjustable part is really the key, I think, to why a carbon tax works better than a Green New Deal. And that's what the eco-right is all about, is how do we come up with a solution that is market-based, doesn't involve a huge government takeover of the economy or socialism, or, you know, some overreach. Like, if you look at the Green New Deal, it's mostly based on regulation, government mandates, lots of spending, and just new rules. It would create this Gordian knot of regulation and red tape, and it would probably crush the economy in the process. Conservatives think that there's a better way to do this by putting markets in charge. And if you think about it in terms of, if I can make an analogy here, think about the Green New Deal as our convoluted tax code with all these different rules and loopholes and exceptions and credits. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly how to navigate our tax code. Whereas a carbon tax is more just like the flat tax. It's very simple. There's no picking winners and losers on the side of government. You're just sending a price signal to the market that says, this is how much pollution costs. And if you release carbon emissions as part of your industrial process, or if you're mining coal and selling coal, and that's going to create carbon emissions, you're going to pay some sort of tax.
So it's largely a tax on businesses, corporations who would emit these things into the atmosphere.
Correct. And
who's responsible for measuring it? Like, how do you quantify it? How do you measure it to a specific plant, factory, or whatever it is? I mean, who's responsible for that? How can that be really measured and calculated?
I leave that to the engineers and the policy experts to figure out. I don't really know, frankly. But I know that there's, you know, presumably there's a plan for that. There's been a lot of studies around this. This is the most economists agree that this is the best solution to combat climate change. And another, getting back to your carbon tariffs question, like where does
because so far the carbon tax sounds horrible in my view. I've been biting my lip a bit, but let's hear the tariffs.
And by the way, I'll caveat all this by saying that if you're skeptical about whether or not climate change is, you know, real or an issue that is worthy of addressing, then all of this sounds horrible. Like, why would you ever do this if this wasn't a serious problem?
I'm in that camp. I'm definitely in that camp. But I do like a good debate, and I do like a good discussion. I'm always open to hearing, you know, opposing views. I'm not trying to be, you know, closed-minded here. But I am. I would, you know, if someone said, you know, do I support protecting the environment? Yes. You know, I think the national parks are a great thing. I think preserving, you know, the beauty of this country, much of which is natural beauty that we are, you know, we've been gifted with. I think that is something that we should do. I think that's a good aspiration. I am not so much in favor of, you know, maybe chasing after, you know, a boogeyman, maybe climate change and building massive policies around it. But again, I'm open and I'm willing to hear you out. But the word tariff got me intrigued, so I definitely am a little more biased on that front.
All right. So the reason the tariff or the border adjustable tax comes in is it's the same reason that the Green New Deal fails. It's not enough for one country to take a lot of action against climate change and reduce their carbon emissions. If the United States overnight converted to a completely green economy, stopped consuming fossil fuels and became completely carbon neutral, there are two things that would happen. Our emissions would go down and other countries' emissions would probably go up because fossil fuels would become so cheap that any country that passes up the possibility and the opportunity to acquire those fossil fuels and use them to turbocharge their industry, like China would be all over that. India would be all over that. They would just buy cheap oil, cheap coal, while the U.S. is spending $94 trillion or wherever it is to implement this Green New Deal. So you can't just have the U.S., you know, spend money to create this clean energy economy without the rest of the world doing the same. It's a global problem. It requires a global solution. So that's why if you implement a carbon tax to help clean up our industry here at home, then you also need to make it a tariff at the border for any country that doesn't have a reciprocal carbon tax. So in that way, you don't punish American industry with this tax, and you encourage other countries to implement the same tax because they would rather be filling their treasuries with this tax money than giving it to our treasury.
So this would have to be in addition to any some kind of domestic carbon tax. It couldn't just exist on its own.
I don't think it would. I don't think it could exist on its own. No, it needs to be. It needs to be reciprocal across borders. And the reason it works is, and the reason it works that the U.S. does it is the U.S. is such a major global trade partner for so many countries that, and our market is so important for so many economies out there that if we implement this tax and, you know, China has to pay it at the border, but, you know, say Vietnam doesn't have to because they've implemented their own carbon tax, so their goods flow across the border without facing that tariff, then a lot of competition is going to move to Vietnam. And their industry is going to benefit.
Sure. I mean, I think our market is definitely shrinking. I mean, a lot of these massive corporations seem to be bending over backwards to the CCP and to China's demands, mostly because they have this billion plus person market. I mean, look at what the NBA is doing. You look at what other, you know, corporate interests are doing. I know Hollywood, Disney, you know, every time they want to censor something in Mulan or whatever the hell it is, you know, they're bending over backwards because China is really becoming, whether we want to admit it or not, that the key market. And if they're not going to play ball with this carbon tax policy, then it seems like it's only going to, you know, hamstring us because we have the domestic taxation through these carbon taxes on whatever's left of our industrial base, and now we're adding on top of it this carbon tariff, which I'm also curious what the enforcement mechanism is. Like, you know, we're measuring a plant in China or Wuhan or something, and whatever is produced out of that factory is taxed. So if they make a trinket in Wuhan and that trinket comes out of a factory that releases this amount of carbon, there's a tax applied to that trinket. Am I getting it right?
Yeah, that's roughly right. I mean, I don't know exactly how you would make sure that there's no cheating, which is what you're alluding to, and that China is actually enforcing their carbon tax to the letter in the same way that we are.
I'd be fine with selling tariffs to people if we base the rates on carbon emission from whatever country. I mean, I don't care what the, you know, because I know most of those tariffs are going to be leveled on China anyway. So I think it's almost like a good, you know, it's a good marketing gimmick almost to be like, oh, no, these are green tariffs. That's how we get liberal Dems on board, because we're taxing, you know, high polluting Chinese, you know, industrial centers. And that wins over, you know, a blue collar voter in Pennsylvania, but maybe it'll win over, you know, a Brooklyn, you know, hipster drinking mocha or something.
Well, there are a lot of liberal Democrats that think a carbon tax is just a like not a good enough gesture because they don't believe in the power of markets to actually solve problems.
Oh, well, they're insane. They're insane. I think it's way too much. And if they're thinking it's not enough, they're out of their minds. But okay.
Yeah. So this is considered a weak solution by many liberal circles, and it's considered a too liberal solution in many conservative circles. So it is a very lovely hill to defend here in the political landscape. But listen, let's talk about China for a minute, because I think China is also at the very crux of this whole thing. Because if you think about this from just a think about climate from just a nationalist standpoint, we know, like, look at the science. There's enough evidence to show that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas and it warms the planet. Right now, China is emitting more and more of it every year. Since the mid-2000s, U.S. carbon emissions have been level or declining, whereas China's have doubled. And they continue to go up. And as part of their Belt and Road Initiative, China is building coal plants all over the world. They're building them all over Africa, all over developing Asia, in South America. And these are dirty, primitive coal plants that emit tons of carbon dioxide. And we're just kind of giving them a pass on that. And they're using this to peddle influence around the world at the detriment of the U.S.
Well, that's the hypocrisy of the eco left, is that they're so worried about strangling what's left of coal and all these various industries in this country, many of which have bent over backwards, you know, to reinvent themselves, to implement and to self-regulate, to implement various things to curb their pollution and to self-regulate themselves. They're so hell-bent on destroying those industries, mostly because it seems that those industries employ people that they can't stand, that they view as deplorables, the coal miners, the oil rig workers, you know, all these blue-collar you know, unwashed masses, so to speak, in middle America, they're so hell-bent on crushing that economy. I mean, we just saw it recently with the Keystone Pipeline decision. But like you're saying, you have, you know, China, which is essentially, you know, peddling influence in our own Congress, with our own politicians, and globally with the Belt and Road Initiative. And they're basically like, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?
Yeah, well, we shouldn't just let them get away with that. I mean, there is a, like I said, I think there's a nationalist argument for how do you stop China from doing these things?
Right.
The irony here also is that Xi Jinping is quite the green evangelical himself. Like he wants to clean up China's economy at home while he's exporting his dirty coal abroad. That's because he recognizes that the future is not the coal industry. It's in green energy jobs.
Right.
And if he can set up China as the clean energy industrial powerhouse of the world, that's also going to benefit China in the long term. And that's where I think we really need to get wise about how we move forward from here. Whether or not, you know, liberal Democrats try to kill off the coal industry is slowly winking out. Like it's whether you step on it while it's drowning or if you just sit there and let it drown, like the coal industry is starting to go away. It's not going to come back. And the reason for that is simple economics. Coal is more expensive than most renewable energy forms at this point. It's dirtier. It costs more to extract and to burn and to maintain the plants that burn them. Forget wind and solar and nuclear and all that for a minute, and just look at what natural gas has done to coal ever since the fracking boom started.
Right.
Coal used to account for, you know, the majority of our electricity grid, and it's one of the lowest percentages of any fuel source now. I mean, you're seeing that all over.
That's a market force. That's a market, and that's fine. I mean, there certainly have been regulations and certain things that have hurt coal, and I think there'll probably always be a place for coal, particularly in some states. But look, I have no problem with, you know, natural market forces, you know, pushing them out, whether it's fracking or otherwise. But you know, you brought up a good point with China, what Xi Jinping is doing. I mean, he definitely is trying to shift. And you talked about the correlation. I mean, they're obviously, their carbon emissions have gone up at the same rate that they've industrialized. I mean, their level of industrialization now is nothing compared to what it was in the 80s. I mean, over the 80s was nothing compared to what it is now. It's been a massive positive trajectory, mostly due to our own trade policies, et cetera. So they've already hyper-industrialized. They've got over that hump of industrialization. Now what they're trying to do, it seems, is they're trying to become the new consumer market. They want to be what the United States has been for the last 20, 30, 40 years, where they want China to be the market for everyone's goods. They want China to be the main market for the NBA, which is an easy example to use. But they want a massive emergent middle class. They want to shift the dirtiness overseas. They want to shift that grossness overseas and turn China. And that's only going to hurt the ability for the United States to actually leverage anything along the lines of what you're talking about, because, you know, they could wipe their hands of any culpability in whatever international body, whether it's, you know, the non-binding Paris Climate Accord or whatever ends up replacing it. So because they're shifting it to, you know, whatever, some random country in Africa. And, you know, that just makes it more complicated for us. But I do like the idea of a nationalist angle trying to, you know, beat China up a bit under the guise of environmentalism. I like that. I mean, I think that's great because I think it's good politics at home and I think it's good politics abroad, even though I may kind of see it a bit as a gimmick, but you know, that's just me.
Well, I would say beating up China and creating, like transforming the US into a green industrial powerhouse under the guise of environmentalism is a heck of a lot better than allowing a socialist takeover of this country under the guise of environmentalism.
What a great, you know, just, I don't even know what the argument is where you're trying to just like, well, you know, we don't want communism, but take this, buddy, take this. This is like in the middle right here. I see what you're up to, Sweeney. I see what you're up to. But some more direct questions. What do you think about this Keystone Pipeline decision? I mean, it kind of ties into China. Obviously, this is a pretty strategic pipeline that was part of making us energy independent, which I think a lot of people tend to forget a few years ago, you know, how, you know, becoming energy independent was almost like a pipe dream. And we really are energy independent now. I mean, we have the resources for the most part to, you know, manage our own energy sector. That was something unheard of just a matter of a decade or so ago. The Keystone Pipeline is part of that grander strategic vision. And it's already been cut off. And, you know, that's cost a lot of jobs. And the impetus for ending the Keystone Pipeline was largely environmentalism, even though we know probably behind the scenes it was more, you know, Chinese influence and other influence who were trying to keep, you know, the U.S. weaker, whether it was Saudi Gulf interests or China's interests. I mean, there were geopolitical forces at here that had nothing to do with environmentalism that wanted to see this get squashed.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with stopping construction of a pipeline under an environmental guise whenever you have other pipelines that are operational throughout the country. I think government needs to be a fair arbiter of trade and business, and government needs to keep its word. Whenever it green lights a project should go ahead, and it shouldn't be, you know, businesses shouldn't have to adjust by the shifting winds of politics in Washington, D.C. If they decide that they're going to allocate capital and invest and create jobs, government needs to step out of the way and let them do that. In my mind, this was a decision that had already been made, and government should have abided by it. I don't agree with the Biden administration's decision to cancel the pipeline. And frankly, I think that there are other ways, better ways, that you can encourage environmentalism and clean energy without sticking your thumb on the scale in such a heavy-handed and a regulatory way. This is one thing where I think the eco-right distinguishes itself a lot from the environmental left, is we're very anti-red tape and anti-regulation and mandates. Like, this is the kind of thing that we never want to see happen, because it's a direct intervention by government into markets and businesses.
Your view is just, if you want to pollute, you have to pay it a premium.
Yeah, I think you should, like, if they want to build the Keystone Pipeline, they just have to pay a tax on, some sort of levy on what the carbon emissions are going to be, unless they can come up with a way to burn the oil cleaner. And that's the reason why conservatives on the eco-right like the idea of a carbon tax so much, is because we have a lot of faith in American capitalism and American businesses and the innovation and inventiveness of our people to come up with new ways to do things that are cleaner and produce fewer carbon emissions.
I mean, the devil advocate in me would push back and say, well, you know, that's all well and good, but in the short term, you're just encouraging offshoring. That same plant is just going to be built abroad. That same pipeline will be built abroad. That factory that you thought would, you know, retweak something to cut back on their emissions would just move abroad. It's just going to, you know, accelerate the offshoring phenomenon that we've seen. And because we do live in a global kind of environment and marketplace, it's easy for them to do, you know, and that's maybe where, you know, there may be some synergy with the right, because the populist right, because, you know, they want to put other policies in that have nothing to do with environmentalism, but to stop that sort of, you know, that globalist trajectory, that sort of free flow of capital over borders with, you know, with absolute free trade and very little in terms of, you know, borders in general. Maybe that could be some kind of a common ground to bring the two forces together, because I think you can't just do, because your idea of a carbon tariff at the end of the day was a mechanism to fix any shortfalls with just a domestic carbon tax, because as you mentioned, the global economy, it's not going to really solve the issues. It's just going to shift, you know, the geography of where these emissions are coming from. It's not going to really end the total emission, so to speak.
Well, and there's a theory that if the U.S. were to lead on this and implement a domestic carbon tax, there are many other developed countries that would immediately follow suit. Canada, our next door neighbor, being one.
I wouldn't call them developed.
Debatable, I guess. The European Union, Japan, Australia, although Australia has its own reasons for not wanting to do that. They rely a lot on coal exports to China. But we think that there would be a lot of developed countries that have more advanced industries that are tougher to offshore, that you know, have advanced manufacturing processes that would reciprocate some kind of carbon tax. And then you create this whole like developed market trade bloc that is more powerful than just the United States standing alone. I mean, it would, if the ideal way to do this would be to do it in sync with a lot of our allies.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of those nations, you know, they have their flaws and, you know, they're also engaging in destructive policies, whether it's the EU or Canada, et cetera. I know Justin Trudeau is having a lot of issues with these Western provinces and, you know, his crackdown on, you know, the Alberta oil industry, et cetera, fracking, you know, whatever it is. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of dynamics that are at play domestically that are at play in many of these countries that I think could both stop that and make just, you know, it also just seemed to be like a suicide pact. Again, I'm pushing back here. It seems like a suicide pact with these Western nations.
Do you have to make that dark of an analogy?
Well, it just seems like, oh, you know, we're all gonna tax our own industries, you know, to stick it to the Chinese, and the Chinese are just going to be like laughing and be like, all right, you idiots do that and we'll keep building and you keep buying and the system goes on. I mean, yeah, you could bring on the EU and Canada and whoever, but I don't think it's enough. And I'm not sold on the baseline idea. I'm just talking about, you know, these additional ideas on top of it. But I mean, before we get too much in the weeds on this, I mean, I'm also curious, the eco right, some other major kind of environmental energy issues, whether it's fracking or let's start with fracking. Fracking is a big one because he also had the fracking ban. You know, we're not going to ban fracking. Then he ends up banning fracking. That's huge in Pennsylvania. That's huge in a lot of these states. You know, I've been to the southern tier in New York, and it's right over the border from PA. And it's like these desolate ghost towns. You know, they're completely bankrupt. They're abandoned. You know, they have nothing going on. And then you cross over into the Pennsylvania side of the tier. And it's fantastic. Everything is going well. They have it's like a boom economy. Fracking is allowed. And, you know, things are doing pretty well there. So, I mean, what do you say to these people? And what does the eco right say about fracking?
Well, I can't speak for the whole eco right here because like many political tribes in America, it's messy, full of lots of different coalitions, and I'm sure different people believe different things. But at its core, the eco-right, at least the Republican, believes that government has a very poor track record of picking winners and losers. We don't think that there should be any regulation that, like, or heavy-handed government approach towards cleaning up our industry. So, I'm actually personally a big proponent of fracking. I think that the fracking boom has been great for American energy and our energy independence. It has been a large contributor to the swelling of natural gas and as a power source. One of the major replacements for all the dirty coal that we talked about earlier has been natural gas. One of the reasons we have so much natural gas is because of fracking. So from my perspective, fracking has been amazing for the environment. Natural gas is a less dirty energy source than coal. It releases fewer carbon emissions. So I think fracking is great, and I'm very pro fracking. I don't think we should be banning it.
Well, that's interesting. I wasn't expecting that. I guess you are certainly the minority of this minority. So you're really pushing niche territory here. But I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, that there's a lot of people who, you know, are up in arms about fracking, but they don't seem to look at the bigger picture like you do and see, you know, marginal gains. I mean, if you are worried about the environment, would you rather come from coal or would you rather come from natural gas? I mean, there's no such thing as utopia. You're not going to get what you want overnight, but you are making marginal gains in the right direction. But you'll never get there if you, you know, put these arbitrary bans on fracking and whatever else, which is stuff that some states like New York have done. And it's been very detrimental to our economy, and it hasn't really done anything to certainly improve the environment. I mean, what about some other issues about alternative sources of energy? I mean, is there anything on the horizon that interests you, that gets you excited in terms of energy? I mean, whether it's nuclear or solar, et cetera.
Nuclear.
Really?
Absolutely. Like, if you think about what energy source out there is right at our fingertips and produces tons of energy and is completely carbon emission free, nuclear is right there. And we are developing much more advanced nuclear technology that's safer, that's cleaner, that can be adopted on a massive scale, especially small modular reactors. Those are promising new technology. In South Korea, they recently had a big breakthrough with fusion technology. So if we can figure out a way to implement nuclear energy on a very wide scale, our energy problems could be pretty much solved. Our energy problems and a lot of our environmental problems could be very quickly mitigated. So I'm very pro-nuclear, and I think it's gotten a bad rap over the years. You know, we've had there's a couple of disasters that are often cited in the argument against nuclear, Chernobyl being the most prominent. But again, I would point towards the fact that that happened in a socialist regime, which, you know, they have poor track records both on health and human safety and the environment. And so the fact that this type of disaster would happen in Soviet Russia isn't all that surprising.
Chernobyl's always been an indictment against, you know, the Soviets rather than nuclear energy. I think people have used it, you know, as some kind of scapegoat, so to speak, or when reality it was Soviet mismanagement, lack of transparency, lack of accountability, and just the way they just structured society that allowed that nonsense to happen.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, like, there are obviously some dangers with nuclear. Like, a nuclear meltdown would be bad. But like I said, the advances in technology these days and like the modern safety standards that we have at nuclear power plants makes it very unlikely. And if you believe that, if you actually believe what the damages could be from climate change, and like what are the costs of not acting and not cleaning up our carbon emissions, then you weigh the costs and benefits, and nuclear is very attractive. It wins every time.
Anything else? I mean, what about solar, wind? Is that all just a bunch of nonsense for the most part in terms of scalability and feasibility?
No, it's not nonsense. In fact,
no, not at all. You conservative.
No, I mean, but at this point, wind and solar are some of the cheaper than a lot of fossil fuels. I think, you know, at the time that Jimmy Carter was putting solar panels on the White House, solar was extremely expensive and it was sort of a symbolic gesture. And it didn't make sense to adopt widespread solar. But these days, solar is pretty cheap and it's pretty efficient. And we're creating new, more efficient photovoltaic cells every day. And, you know, the sun is all around us. So it's a good energy source if we can harness it well. Don't have to burn anything. Just take it from the sunlight. Windmills are an interesting one, and you're going to like this, Gavin, because okay. I think windmills, especially offshore windmills, stay with me, could be a very promising energy source. Offshore, the wind is much stronger than it is onshore. And some of the most sought after offshore windmill projects have been naturally on the coasts and in blue states. There was a famous windmill project off the coast of Massachusetts.
Right. I remember this. Yeah.
And guess who scuttled that one?
Well,
Kennedy and a bunch of coastal liberals who didn't want their views obscured of the, you know, the Nantucket Sound. And
right.
But that's the type of, like, if they had built that, it would have powered, it would have met like 20% of Massachusetts energy.
Wow.
And allow it to go forward. And windmills, I mean, they can be like, you can build a lot of them. They're very environmentally friendly. There's misinformation out there about how many birds they kill, but they don't really, like, buildings and cities kill way more birds than windmills. Bridges across seawater kill more birds than windmills do.
Well, speaking of killing, you know, sea life, I mean, the whole plastic ban, plastic straw ban. I mean, there tends to be a lot of ridiculous policies that seem like a lot more like virtue signaling. I mean, here in New York, I can't even get a plastic bag from a store anymore. You can't get a plastic straw. I mean, you talk about regulations. I mean, these are some kind of ridiculous regulations that I'm struggling to see, you know, are really beneficial. I mean, plastic is still around. It's not going to really make a dent in plastic use. I mean, you can recycle plastic. I'm all for if you want to recycle it. But just wholesale banning of things seems a bit ridiculous, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always more in favor of letting the market decide. And I think in some ways, I think the market is deciding, because there are a lot of companies that are implementing the plastic straw bans themselves and moving to different straws that, you know, they're doing it because
they suck. Those straws suck. They suck. You know, this, Sweeney.
The straws do suck. And my problem with gestures like that is that because the straws suck so much, they just turn people off of the whole like environmental movement to begin with. Like,
it's just like a movement of nuisances. That's it. Like, that's what it seems to be coming. And it's not, I mean, speaking for you guys, it doesn't seem to be good for promoting your ideals.
Well, and it's something that's very personal. It goes in your mouth. Like, why would you start with that as like the gateway drug to recycling environmentalism? Like, you don't want to start with something that people put in their mouth and they feel the texture of this cardboard straw disintegrating. And they think that, or they have that happen to them, and they say, "Ooh, I hate these environmentalists." Like, why would you start there? It's a tactical error that I think plagues the environmental left. They continue to score these own goals against themselves. It just hits a lot of, you know, conservative Americans against them.
Or just moderate and non-affiliated Americans. I think conservatives have their minds made up, but, you know, the regular Joe Schmo, who's not really paying attention, now all of a sudden he can't get his groceries in a plastic bag, and he's walking around with these brown paper bags, everything's ripping and his straw is disintegrating in his mouth. He's probably thinking, you know, this is ridiculous. This is stupid. This is not improving anyone's life. This is just to make some coastal elites feel better about themselves, to pass some, you know, stupid feel good laws that have no real tangible, you know, benefits. Same thing with the fur ban. I know they banned the fur. I mean, you know, this is more, you know, animal rights, I guess, but I guess it ties into it. I mean, they've done a lot of these ridiculous policies here in New York, and they all just seem to be just sort of just ways to create more nuisances rather than actually solve any tangible problems.
Well, I think that's one of my biggest complaints about the environmental left, and why I'm drawn to the eco right rather than the environmental left, is I think they spend a lot of time on issues that aren't directly related to just the core issue, which is how do we reduce human carbon emissions? And, you know, they interpose different issues like, you know, racial justice and social equality, things that, you know, let's say that those are, you know, they're goals and worthy goals of society, but you don't want to mix the message of just how do we reduce carbon emissions? Like, they're constantly muddying the waters. And it makes sense, because if you think about climate change as an issue, like it crosses a lot of different political boundaries. It's national security. It's economic. There is a social element to it. And then there's also the environmental element. I think the left will often focus on the social and the environmental without paying attention or enough attention on the national security and economic sides of the equation. And that's where I think the eco right can come in, and where Republicans can come in as more policy oriented and solutions oriented, to try to come up with a more elegant solution to the problem rather than just saying like, no, you can't do this.
No, that's interesting. And I hope you don't hear the church bells in the background. I am across the street from a church, but, what do you have to, I do want to tackle, you know, the core of this that we kind of danced around a bit, which is climate change. You know, if it's more, you know, through human involvement or natural, I mean, you know, there's parts of me that would like to say, you know, it is natural. It's a natural phenomenon. We've had little ice age. We've had periods of very cooling. We've had periods of warming. We've had different cycles. It's been very cyclical through the last, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 years. And it's a natural phenomenon. And, you know, there's only so much that we can do to impact it either way. I mean, would you say to the people that say that? I mean, I'm pretty much saying it, but what would you say to me?
I would say there is a natural cycle, right? We have different little ice ages that come in and out. And times of warming. But then you have to look at, all right, how are humans impacting that balance? And if you just drill down to the, first of all, let's go to one of my favorite arguments against climate change, which is that scientists in the 1970s thought that we were on the verge of an ice age. Oh, like, they got it wrong then. I mean, they yeah, they did get it wrong then. And also, that was 50 years ago. I mean, science has advanced a lot since the 1970s. In the 1970s, doctors were saying that babies should be sleeping on their stomachs. And we found out later that that was causing a lot of sudden infant death syndrome. And they changed that. Now they should be sleeping on their backs. If anybody's watching this and has learned nothing so far, make sure your baby sleeps on their back until they're old enough to roll over. But that's just an example of how like science can advance over the course of 50 years. And we know a lot more and we have more evidence now than we did before that we have looked at so many reasons why the planet could be getting warmer. We have been measuring it against history, and each year that we, or each decade of the last three decades has been some of the warmest on record since 1850. So what's been happening since the Industrial Revolution? There's one thing that's been happening that we can measure, and that is that atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide have gone up. They've more than doubled. They've close to tripled. And it's very clear that more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere just makes the planet warmer. Not a ton warmer. It's not like suddenly, you know, it's not like we were averaging, you know, 70 degrees in the summer and now we're 90 degrees in the summer. Like we're talking about a few degrees, which may not sound like a lot, but it upsets a lot of different natural processes. And we can measure the effects of it now. For instance, the jet stream has slowed down because the temperature differentials between the Arctic and the equator have diminished somewhat due to the warming. As the jet stream slows down, hurricanes move slower. You want to know why, like, hurricanes have been moving more slowly and just kind of like stalling off the eastern coast of the United States and getting really big? It's because the jet stream is not as powerful. That jet stream also shields Florida and a lot of the coastal states from direct impacts from a lot of these hurricanes. It's going to be easier for them to break through over time as it slows and weakens further. So it's not like one catastrophic thing that happens that causes that suddenly, like, it's not like The Day After Tomorrow, which was a horrible movie. And you know, everything just suddenly fell apart and, you know, you had wolves running through New York City, which I never really understood that part of the movie, but made for a nice special effect. But it's not going to be like that. It's more just going to be kind of like a, okay, instead of, you know, one wildfire a year in your state, you have, you know, five, then 10. Instead of one major hurricane per season, you have three. Instead of, you know, 10 days of flooding out of the year, you have 20, 30. It's small differences, but it makes a big impact on whether or not the place you live is a pleasant place to live. And that's why I think when you talk to traditional Republicans, people like, you know, hunters, fishermen, farmers, people in the outdoors, I mean, talk to farmers in Iowa. They'll tell you right now that their fields flood a lot more than they used to, and it's harder to grow corn. So they're becoming more environmentally conscious, and they see the impact of this.
Ethanol.
Whatever. Ethanol. I don't really have anything to say about ethanol.
Wasn't that the big, wasn't that the great dream a few years ago with the corn from Iowa? That would be the future.
Yeah. So this goes back to my point earlier about government has a terrible track record of picking winners and losers. And I don't think the government should be in the business of picking winners and losers. Also, I mean, think about the George Bush's big speech. He gave that State of the Union speech about how we're all going to be driving hydrogen cars in, I don't know, 10 years or something. Where are they? I'm not driving a hydrogen car. Have you seen any? I think we spent billions of dollars trying to develop hydrogen cars only to find out that there's not really a safe, stable way to create a hydrogen fuel cell without potentially turning your car into a miniature version of the Hindenburg.
And then there was the hybrid fad, you know, with the Priuses and whatever. I mean, there seems to have been a lot of fads over the years. which again is definitely hurts your movement in terms of people being skeptical of it, because it always seems to be, you know, the new flavor of the month, the new thing that, you know, coastal college educated elite liberals can do to make themselves feel good. Oh, they drive a Prius. Okay, what's next? Oh, now they have a Tesla. They have another expensive car. You know, they're buying things that are out of reach for most people. And they then on top of that, you know, preach their virtue about saving the environment. I think that's kind of plagued the environmentalist movement. And again, I have some sympathies here and there. I'm not completely dismissing everything you're saying, but I do think there's like this cultural component that definitely turns a lot of people off. But I mean, look, you know, I think if there are policy positions that could be reasonable, that could be, you know, effectuated without really hurting, you know, businesses and industry, then, you know, we're always open to discuss it. But, you know, I'm not sure I've been particularly sold today, but I do think, you know, I appreciate where the eco right is.
I can't believe after years of talking to you about this, that it finally turned you.
Well, yeah, this is a much more civil discussion. But yeah, I mean, look, I appreciate at least the eco rights sensibilities in terms of regulation and understanding a lot of these things are kind of ridiculous and, you know, fracking bans and stuff. I mean, a lot of the positions you put forward, I was actually surprised with and I was actually impressed with. It was something that I did not expect you to say. And I was actually pleased that at least the eco right, or, you know, at least the portion that you may represent or not represent, has some sensibilities that I could agree with. I mean, I definitely think, you know, there are huge issues at the EPA. We could talk about that. I mean, I definitely think they are, you know, if you want to talk about burdensome regulations and nitpickiness and really just coming down on development and human progress for no reason. I mean, there's a lot to point out in that. And that agency, which is only going to be weaponized again over the next 4 years. So I'm definitely not excited for that. But we could talk about this for hours. I know you have a growing family to attend to, so I do not want to keep you for very long, but this has been a great discussion. And I want to pass the last word off to you if there's anything you want to say in conclusion. And please let everyone know where they can follow you, your work. And wait, actually, one last question. Republican, what is that again? It's for energy. What is the N?
The official name of the nonprofit is the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. Republican is the nickname, and you know it's meant to sound like Republican, but it's Republic with an EN at the end because we're environmentally friendly.
All right. Yeah, we need to hire a new branding team over there and revisit.
You're good at this stuff, Gavin. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know about naming and things, but you know it is what it is. Look, it's cute. It is its thing. You know, you guys do it. So
Speaking of branding, what do you call your viewers of the Waxcast?
Waxcasters.
They're not just waxers.
Waxers, wax offers. You know, there's different factions among them. But you know, they're the people that stick through the whole live stream online, which, you know, God bless you guys because you guys are dedicated, because I just literally put these things up without any notice and someone just stops everything they're doing during the day to watch. So I got to give them credit. Then there's the people that listen to the podcast because I pull the audio after. So we got the wax casters, we got the waxers, we got the wax offers. Yeah, there's a lot of names. But anyway.
And the people who don't watch are called the Wainers. Is that right?
Something like that, yeah, or just scumbags and not good people. I assume some are good people. I assume some. But you're a good person, Mr. Sweeney, and I'm glad you have you on the show. I definitely want to have you back on, talk about a whole slew of different topics. But please, the last word to you, and please let us know where we can follow you, your latest articles, musings, and commentary.
Absolutely. If you'd like to learn more about the eco-right, I encourage you to go to republicen.org. And there you can learn more about resources that you can peruse and see all our latest propaganda. And you can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at John H. Sweeney just at John H. Sweeney on Twitter is my Twitter handle. So.
Yeah, don't email him, please, guys. Yeah, he gets enough. I used to email someone that I thought was you without the H, and God, you know, they were not fans. But anyway, guys, thank you all.
I really want to meet that guy someday because you're not alone.
Yeah, someday. But anyway, guys, thank you all for tuning in. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, the whole shebang. And we will be coming to you soon with more episodes of the Waxcast. John, thank you again for coming on.
Thank you. Nice to see you.